Good morning. Welcome to the third lecture in our series on the regulation of financial institutions. Today's lecture will focus primarily on the alternative strategies exercise that I assigned to you in the last class. Then, I'd like to relate that exercise to our previous discussion of activities restrictions on depository institutions and discuss a few examples of how activities restrictions have been reformed in the United States over the past decade or so. Before beginning today's discussion, however, let me just mention a few administrative items. First, I'm glad to hear from Mr. Tong and several of you that the casebooks and statutory supplements have now arrived. From now on, I will make my assignments directly from the casebook and the supplement where applicable, and will only put additional materials on our webpage when there is something I want you to take a look at that is not in either the casebook or the supplement. I also want to mention how pleased I am with the discussion comments that were made over the past week with respect to Lecture 2. I thought the analysis presented by many members of the class was quite good, and I plan to refer to several of the comments in the course of today's lecture. So thank you very much. I appreciate your effort and experimenting with this technology, and I think this past week has demonstrated that it can be a very useful supplement to the lectures. Let me turn now to the subject of today's talk, which is activities regulation in the area of depository institutions. Towards the end of the hour, I hope to say a few introductory comments about capital standards for depository institutions, which will constitute the primary focus of our discussion for next week. So let's turn now to the alternative strategies exercise I gave you last week. As you'll recall, that exercise involved a hypothetical depository institution with $100 of assets backed by $99 in deposits and $1 of equity. So a highly leveraged institution, but one with roughly the same balance sheet as, for example, the unidentified institution A had in our initial class discussion. The question that we asked you to consider was how to respond to three strategic choices made available to this institution. As I mentioned to you at the end of the last lecture, one can analyze each of these strategies in a similar way to consider who would bear the costs and who would gain the returns of various alternative scenarios. Strategy A, which might be considered a medium risk strategy, offered three different possible outcomes, the most likely middle case, an 8% return on assets, and then two other possible cases, a best case and a worst case scenario, with 6% return and 9% return. Now, I refer to this as a medium risk allocation of assets because the returns are spread apart in about a medium way as compared with other possible strategies. The best case of return of 9% is 2 percentage points higher than the worst case return of 7%. Now, this leaves an average return of 8% for the institution, and the profits are basically evenly distributed across the owner's interests. In the middle case, the owners would earn $1 on their investment. In the worst case, they'd earn nothing, and in the best case, they'd earn 2%. So their average return would be 1%. Now, let's begin by contrasting this with strategy B. Strategy B, I denominate here as a low-risk allocation of assets because the returns are fairly tightly bunched around 7.5%. The worst case is only 7.25%, just a quarter of a percentage point lower, and the best case scenario is 7.75%, just a quarter of a percentage point above. Now, the average return here is 7.5%, which of course is lower than the average return of strategy B. And similarly, the owner's profits here are expected to be 50 cents, but will be relatively tightly distributed around that point at 75 cents and 25 cents. So you could summarize these two examples, just with the information I've already put up on the slides, in this table comparing returns. The average return for the institution declines from 8% to 7.5% in strategy B, and the expected profits for the owners declines from $1 to half a dollar. For depositors, both these illustrations are identical because they expect to suffer no losses in either scenario. Yeah. Well, I think you can see the answer to that question if you look back at the distribution of returns in strategy A. What Mr. Pengbing is mostly concerned about is the worst case scenario here, where the owners get no profit from this institution in strategy A. Now, admittedly, their average profit is higher of 1%, but if the institution were to pursue strategy B, they would be guaranteed at least a 0.25% return in each case. So, from the perspective of the owners, Mr. Pengbing believes that it is better to have a no-risk strategy as opposed to a strategy which has risk in the terms of no profit under certain scenarios. Now, it's certainly the case that one could argue what Mr. Pengbing has argued, and it's a rational response for a purely risk-averse owner. However, one of the points that I would make about this from the perspective of the owner is it assumes a high degree of risk aversion. And if there are any sort of alternative risk-sharing arrangements available to the owner, there are ways to prevent the individual or group of individuals from suffering in the case of zero profits. Now, one common example in the United States of such a strategy would be for the owner to make a diversified set of investments in different banking institutions, each of which followed a strategy A of some sort, and then being able to diversify the risks that one institution or a few institutions in a particular year will not have successful operations and will therefore not be able to return any profits. So if there's a possibility for the owner to diversify into other investments that have slightly different cycles of risk, then it would be possible for the owners to get the $1 return on their investments and not have to lower their returns to 50 cents in order to prevent themselves from having a zero profit period. Another possibility, even if there are no opportunities for diversification of the type that I described, would be for the owner simply to borrow funds from, for example, a bank or another institution in periods during which the institution had low profits and repay those funds in ordinary years. So another strategy is not diversification, but simply borrowing in off years in order to smooth out the cycle of profit returns. If either of those two strategies or a number of other similar kinds of strategies were available, the owner can get the returns of $1 without sacrificing much in the right way of risk and therefore achieve a better return for themselves. So Mr. Pengbing is not incorrect in his defensive strategy B. However, one thing to think about in terms of risk preferences is the alternatives available to individuals to get around the particular risks that are imposed on them in the first instance. Now, most of the people in discussing this problem also made the point that there was zero losses to the depositors. And as the example is constructed, that's absolutely the case. In both strategy A and strategy B, no losses are imposed on the depositors. There is, however, a difference in the two strategies. Under strategy A, the institution is closer to losing money. It breaks even in the worst case scenario. So the potential risk in strategy A is, I suppose, somewhat greater to the depositors. But as constructed, there is no cost imposed on the depositors from either of these examples. And so the real question so far is, from the perspective of the owners, which is better? Most of you preferred strategy A, which is the standard answer, but Peng Bing offers another perspective, which would suggest strategy B might be better. There is, however, another perspective to take on this transaction, which is a societal perspective, a perspective that asks, which kind of an institution do we want? Do we want an institution that seeks out the 8% return investments in preference to the 7.5% return investments in strategy B? So one of the alternative perspectives that I'd invite you to think about is, which of these is better from the perspective of society? Now, to make a judgment about this, you have to really think rather hard about the role of markets and the allocation of resources. But let me just say, one of the perspectives to take on this, and the perspective we take in the United States, is generally that it's preferable for investments that return an 8% yield to be funded than investments that return a 7.5%. So if you imagine institutions out there in the world that will choose one or the other strategy, in some sense, we prefer in the United States and in capitalist-constructed economies for strategy A to be pursued from a social perspective, as long as all the costs associated with that investment are borne by the investors, which they are in these two examples. There is a sense that the strategy A allocations is better from a societal perspective because it produces more profit, it produces more value, which can be shared by the owners, the borrowers, the depositors, the government, a wide variety of individuals and entities can share in the greater returns of strategy A than in strategy B. And in fact, one of the things that we try to do in designing our depository institutions is to encourage them to choose the strategy A's, to choose the most profitable, in a certain sense, the best investments they can find. So in that sense, if we're looking for managers in the United States to run banks, in some sense, we prefer the managers that will pursue strategy A, as opposed to the more risk-averse managers, not to suggest that Peng Bing shouldn't go into the financial services business, but someone who is so risk-averse that they did not want to deploy the institution's assets in the most efficient way would present, in certain respects, a problem. Of course, I should mention at this point, as we'll see, there is in the management of depository institutions and other financial intermediaries strong incentives to take excessive risks. Now, that's not an example that's presented in strategy A and strategy B, but a little later on in the exercise, we'll see some other higher risk strategies, and it's conceivable that we would want to encourage prudent management in order to avoid those higher risk strategies. But as between strategy A and strategy B, when there's no cost imposed on the depositors or on the government, there is an advantage to society to have the resources allocated to their best user as defined by the user that generates the greatest profit. Now I'd like to consider strategy C, which I refer to here as a higher risk allocation of assets. I say this is a higher risk allocation because there is a wider range in the possible returns available under this strategy. In the worst case, the institution could get as low as a 5% yield on assets. In the best case, as high as 13%. So there's an 8% potential differential between the worst case and the best case, compared with strategy A, for example, where there's only a 2% variation. Now, many of you noted in your analysis that the average return on this allocation of assets was 9%, and that is certainly the case. There were, however, some misunderstandings in the comments about the returns available to the owners of the institution, and let me just make sure that it is clear to you why. Under the worst case scenario here, the institution only earns 5% on assets. Its costs for the year are 7% of assets, or $7. So with a 5% return on assets, the institution loses $2. Now, many of you assumed that the owners bore the full brunt of this loss. However, that is not necessarily the case. Remember the shape of the balance sheet of the hypothetical depository institution we are discussing in this exercise. As laid out in the problem, the institution only had $1 of equity. The rest of the funding, $99, came from depositors. In other words, all the money that was at risk for the owners was $1. And when the institution lost $2 in the course of a year, that entire sum would be exhausted, and an additional $1 of cost would be passed on to some other body. Now, in different countries, there would be different arrangements for how this additional loss would be borne. But in the United States, under a system of limited liability, the most common owners, that is, shareholders, are exposed to losses only up to the extent of their investment, which here is $1. So in the United States, the additional dollar of loss, the second dollar of loss, would be passed on to the depositors in the first instance, or if the deposits were insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, as they usually would be in the United States, as long as the individual deposits were not over $100,000, the federal government would bear the cost of the loss, and the individual depositors would receive insurance coverage. So, for purposes of our analysis, $1 of loss is borne by the owners, and another dollar of loss is passed on to the depositors, or potentially to the government in the form of a deposit insurance corporation. What this means is that the institution does yield a 2% expected return, but for the owners, actually the return looks even better than that, because in the worst case scenario, they only suffer $1 of loss, whereas in the best case scenario, they garner the full extent of the institution's profitability, in other words, a $6 profit. If you work out the numbers here, you will see that what actually happens is they have an expected return of $2.25 under strategy C. So it's even more profitable than some of you assumed. The reason that the institution can give this additional projected profit to the owners is that an expected loss of 25 cents is passed on to the depositors. This loss occurs only in the instance of the worst case scenario and will be in the amount of $1, but that happens by assumption 25% of the time, and so their expected loss is 25 cents. This is an important fact to understand both about corporate finance and about financial institutions. In the event of failure, oftentimes some of the costs of failure will be borne by depositors or the public insurance fund. This is occasionally referred to as a moral hazard problem in the literature in the United States on this subject. And what that refers to is the hazard that the owners will be encouraged to take additional risks in order to gain the potential upside and not concern themselves with the worst case scenarios. That moral hazard makes it seem particularly attractive to this institution's owners to engage in strategy C. So there were several of you in filling out the discussion group materials who expressed a preference for strategy C on the assumption that they could get an expected return of $2 under this strategy. And I can only assume that you all will be even more pleased to know that the strategy actually yields a return that's higher than that, 2.25%. So this is an alternative strategy. It can be viewed as a higher risk strategy. A general assumption in the West when dealing with financial matters is that there is a trade-off between risk and return. So in order to get the higher expected return here of 9%, the institution had to take a greater degree of risk. For the owners, this is, if they are willing to tolerate the risk, an attractive proposition because it increases their expected return. Now, the question to ask at this point is this a problem from the perspective of society? Do we care that the institution took this greater risk? As I mentioned to you earlier, we have a preference for higher yield investments, and we want individuals to invest their money in the way that gets them the highest rate of return. Should we be happy about institutions that choose strategy C, or should we be concerned about it if only because of the $0.25 loss that's potentially imposed on depositors? To rephrase this question for a second, let's consider strategy C as compared to the other two strategies we've already discussed. It has a higher average rate of return, higher profitability for the owners. The only drawback that's readily apparent of this approach is that it has a cost imposed on the depositors. The question you need to think about, though, is does this fact make strategy C problematic from our perspective? Is it bad to impose potential costs on depositors? Well, a number of you in your comments expressed the view that it was clearly a bad thing to impose costs on depositors. Gong Yingzi made this point in one of the comments posted on the discussion group, and it was apparent in several other of the comments that depository institutions simply shouldn't allow losses to be imposed on their depositors, and regulation should presumably enforce that requirement. But I want to think about that question for a second and ask you the following hypothetical. If it were possible for the depositors to be compensated for the risk by, for example, receiving an extra payment of, say, 30 cents each year, would that make strategy C more acceptable and perhaps even a preferable strategy for the institution to pursue? Now, understand the implications of what I'm suggesting. If the institutions pursuing strategy C were required to pay an extra 30 cents on all deposits during the course of the year, that would raise the cost of operating the institution to $7.30. Now, what would that do to the relative interests of the various parties? Well, going back to the comparison of returns I just put on the slide, Institution C now has a slightly different sharing of the average returns. The average return is still 9%, which is over cost by roughly 2%. But now the owners only get 1.95 dollars on the institution based on their expectations, whereas the depositors get an extra 5 cents. In other words, the extra 30 cent payment makes the strategy profitable from the perspective of the depositors as compared with strategies A and B. They can get more money out of their investment in institutions that pursue strategy C than they can from any other strategy. So that to the extent that you were assuming that strategy C is bad for depositors, now, on balance, it's better than the other two alternatives we've considered so far. But what about the owners? Is strategy C no longer desirable from the perspective of the owners? Well, under these stylized assumptions, the answer is no, it still is a desirable strategy, at least as compared to the other two, because it still offers the owners the best rate of return. That's because the 30 cents they gave up each year was not nearly as much as the cost of enhanced profitability that they would get from pursuing this strategy over strategy A or strategy B. So it's possible to imagine a situation where there is a correction for the risk-taking implicit in strategy C that forces the owners to bear the full cost of the worst-case scenarios and does not impose external costs on depositors. Does the fact that these arrangements could be made, that is, the fact that higher-risk institutions could pay higher rates of return than lower-risk institutions, make this seem to be a more palatable choice from a societal perspective? Well, I think the answer is it at least complicates the analysis that we've engaged in so far. If you could expect the depositors to impose what is in effect market discipline on the depository institutions that pursue strategy C, it does become somewhat less problematic. The question really becomes, is it a reasonable assumption to expect depositors to take such corrective measures, that is, to insist on higher rates of return from institutions that pursue higher risk strategies? I think there are reasons to be skeptical that this will actually be the case. And in fact, much of our regulatory structure in the United States proceeds under the assumptions that depositors and depository institutions and other investors and financial intermediaries will have a difficult time making the decision. In other words, they will have a difficult time deciding how much to charge or what interest rates to expect from institutions based on their strategies. And if one thinks about it, it's actually a rather complicated decision for the depositors to make. They have to somehow be able to distinguish between institutions pursuing strategies A or B, from whom they should not expect extra interest payments, from those institutions that pursue strategy C. Also, they have a special problem once they decide to make an investment in a strategy A bank, make a deposit in a strategy A bank, because there always is a possibility that the bank will change its strategy while their deposits are in its safekeeping. In other words, they have to be concerned not only with the strategy the institutions are pursuing at the time the deposit is made, but they have to be monitoring it on a somewhat continuous basis to make sure that the terms of their contract does not change. Now, having said these two points, I think some of you may recall my discussion of the justifications for financial regulation in the previous class, when I mentioned that it might still be the case that we would want to impose regulatory restraints on depository institutions, even if we thought depositors were capable of making the decision of which strategy their institutions were pursuing. And the reason we might want to impose restrictions under those circumstances is there might be other reasons to prevent depository institutions from engaging in excessive risk-taking that have nothing to do with the direct interests of depositors. What would the examples be of this? Well, one problem would be systemic concerns from bank runs or bank failures if institutions were to fail. It's perfectly possible to imagine depositors rationally choosing a bank with higher interest rates and higher risk strategies, and those depositors not concerning themselves with the broader societal cause of bank failures. So even if we were persuaded that the depositors themselves were sophisticated, and I think there is reason to doubt this for many depositors in many situations, there might still be reasons to restrict the risk-taking of those institutions. And one of the common ways of decreasing the risk-taking is to impose restrictions on activities that are thought to be associated with high-risk strategies. But activities restrictions are just one of several different ways that governmental action can be used to police the behavior of financial intermediaries. And indeed, one of the things that we will see over the course of this lecture series is that there are a number of different alternatives that are available to the government to assist depositors when they are themselves incapable of monitoring the activities of their institutions. So, aside from activities restrictions, what other mechanisms of regulation might we imagine? Well, one could imagine a tax of some sort on institutions that pursue strategy C. In the United States, for example, we actually have something akin to that in our deposit insurance premium structure, where we have what's known as risk-based depository insurance premiums. Institutions that engage in a greater degree of risk pay substantially higher premiums than those that engage in less risky activities. So one theoretical approach for the government is to impose a higher cost in the form of tax or premium on institutions that engage in strategy C. Of course, that means that the government has to monitor the institutions and have some confidence that it has determined which institutions are engaged in strategy C, high-risk activities, as opposed to lower-risk activities. But that is exactly the kind of decision that the government may be in a better position to make than individual depositors. Another potential strategy for the government is to require institutions pursuing strategy C to have additional capital. Say, in the case that we've been discussing, at least $2 of capital. If you look back through the exercises that we have been working on, imagine what the difference in result would be if the institutions all had $2 or $3 or $4 of capital instead of just one. One of the things that you will find is that in these circumstances, when the capital is greater than the potential loss the institution might incur in a high-risk strategy, such as strategy C, one of the consequences of that is that the depositors themselves do not bear any losses. The owners will incur all of the losses and then can themselves decide which strategy to pursue. Indeed, under those circumstances, it just all the strategies begin to look like strategies A and strategy B, and we are back to the first question we considered, which is, should we encourage institutions to take the highest return strategies, or should we encourage them to pursue less high return strategies? So one theoretical approach to this problem is simply to raise the capital requirements for institutions that have higher risk strategies. Yet another approach, and there are actually many different alternatives here, would be a system of punishment of bank managers whose institutions fail. This solution differs from the previous solutions, which seek to identify risk in advance, sometimes referred to as ex ante, and prevent risk from taking place. A punishment of bank managers is an ex post, an after-the-fact regulatory structure, but it does serve to police risk-taking because bank managers will presumably be cautious if they know that they face personal sanctions should their institutions get into trouble. As I mentioned, we will see examples of these other strategies as we work our way through the lecture series. For now, I want to focus for a moment on activities restrictions as a regulatory strategy. The theory of activities restrictions is to reduce the level of potential risks the institutions can engage in, and thereby protect the interests of depositors and society at large. To put this problem in a slightly more concrete context, consider the Arnold Torres case, which we discussed in last class. As you will recall, in that case, a banking institution was considering an investment in travel agencies. One could think of these two choices as strategy A and strategy C. The loans are A, safe, but not spectacularly profitable line of business, and the banking institution is contemplating the higher returns available, presumably, from a direct investment in travel agents. One way to understand the court's decision, and presumably Congress's decision, is to preclude banks from making the higher risk investments of this sort, in essence, to be precluding strategy C. So one could think of the Arnold Torres case and the general type of restriction it reflects, which is a restriction on bank investments, as seeking to take strategy C off of the table of available investments for depository institutions, leaving them only the choice of strategy A or B. Now, at this point in the lecture, I think it should be perfectly understandable why the government might seek to impose these restrictions, but I'd like to think for a moment at this point about whether or not this is the kind of regulatory restriction that's likely to be effective, or put slightly differently, is this a regulatory strategy that will generate predictable responses? Put yourself in the position of the owner of this institution, or in the position of the several of your classmates that expressed a preference for strategy C, those who wanted the profit, who wanted the $2, and were delighted to find out that they were actually getting $2.25. If strategy C is prohibited, they will be forced back to strategy A or strategy B, or will they? Is there some way that they might be able to gain profits near the level of strategy C and not return to the lower level profits of strategies A and B? Well, to answer that question requires a greater understanding of the possibilities available to banking institutions in the United States or in other jurisdictions. And I would suggest, perhaps, you might find it interesting to read the notes following the Arnold Torres case, in particular the notes that discuss the concept of profit participations, as well as shared space rules. I think that examples of both of these rules can be seen in the statutory supplement. But if you read the notes and the statutory supplement carefully, what you will see is it is possible for institutions to make loans in the United States and also receive in return a profit participation or share of the profit of the business enterprise involved. It's also possible to engage in somewhat similar activities through lease arrangements of the sort made possible by the shared space rules. So, for the situation we are in, for the Arnold Torres case, it's not necessarily the case that banks must choose between loans and investments. There are various other possibilities available to them, which we might denominate strategies D, which are different kinds of investments. They could be loans with profit participations, they could be lease sharing arrangements, or they could simply be loans to less desirable borrowers, but borrowers that are willing to pay a higher rate of return. Conceptually, what I'm saying here is, having said that the category of investments is more risky than loans, we need to really understand whether it's possible to say with confidence that loans are low risk. After all, it's possible to structure a loan that has a much higher degree of risk than an average loan. Simply find a borrower that is willing to pay more, and presumably the only borrowers willing to pay more are those who have themselves greater degrees of risk. In the exercise I gave you, strategy D is in fact what you might consider to be a high-risk strategy. It has a worst-case scenario of a 4% yield on assets, which is 1% lower than the yield, the worst-case yield for strategy C. It also has a rather impressive best-case strategy, which is even more desirable than the best case in strategy C. But the middle case, the expected return, is on balance lower. When one works through all the numbers with this strategy, one sees, lo and behold, the owners get exactly the same rate of expected return. So a profit-maximizing owner might, in fact, be willing to pursue strategy D because it yields to the owners the exact same $2.25% return that was made possible from strategy C. It is, however, in certain respects, a less desirable outcome than strategy C. To see this, line up all four of the strategies again. The average return from the risky loans is actually lower than the strategy C loan and investment approach. And the way the owners can succeed in maintaining exactly the same rate of return is because an even greater degree of risk has been imposed on the depositors. What does this mean for us? Well, it means that one must be somewhat cautious about activities restrictions succeeding without additional supplemental supervision, because simply formally prohibiting investments does not necessarily mean that institutions will revert to low-risk strategies. It may be possible to disguise the kinds of loans they're making. It may be possible to engage in a wide variety of different sorts of activities which increase the rate of return available to the owners. So to the extent that we have depository institutions that are seeking to maximize profits, and in the United States that is, as I mentioned earlier, our operating assumption, we always must be concerned about how the owners will seek to pursue those strategies. Will they seek to pursue a strategy such as strategy C or strategy D and have potentially adverse consequences for the depositors and potentially society at large? So one of the problems with activities restrictions that I want you to be aware of is they're not actually as easy to impose in practice as they sometimes seem to be in theory. As we move towards the end of this segment of the lecture series, let me just say a few concluding comments about activities restrictions in the United States. I think it's fair to say that activities restrictions are one of the dominant regulatory features in the depository institution field and are also quite common for insurance companies and certain other forms of financial intermediaries. In our casebook, the section on the business of banking is largely about activities restrictions and how they have developed in the United States, and in particular the question of what is a permissible business of banking and how does it differ from commerce. If you look further in the casebook, in the subsequent sections of the depository institutions chapters, you will see further discussion of other sorts of activities restrictions, in particular in the materials on lending limits and related matters. And if you look through the statutory supplement, in particular at 12 U.S.C. 24/7, you will see a characteristic list of activities that are permitted for national banks in the United States. So, becoming familiar with activities restrictions and their justifications as a mechanism of controlling risk is, I think, an important part of understanding the regulatory structure in this field. Another theme that you will discover if you read through the relevant sections of our casebook is changes in perspectives on activities restrictions in the United States over the last two or three decades. During the 1970s and 80s, there was increasing concern about the profitability and efficiency of financial institutions, and in particular certain sorts of depository institutions in the United States, such as thrift institutions that had traditionally been restricted to mortgage lending activities. During the 1970s, these particular institutions found themselves facing difficult financial times because their traditional mortgage lending market was not yielding enough return to maintain the solvency of these institutions. Rising interest rates during that period also undermined the profitability of the thrift industry. As a result, there were a number of reforms made at the federal and state level to improve the profitability prospects of thrift institutions, principally through expanding the activities in which they were permitted to engage. One of the lessons of the 1970s, and particularly the 1980s, was the difficulties these new activities posed for our regulatory structure. In part because supervisory authorities were unfamiliar with the new activities, and in part because many of the institutions involved had varying low levels of capital, the moral hazard problems that we were discussing in the course of this lecture surfaced in the thrift industry in the 1980s. A large number of institutions took what appear to have been, in retrospect, excessive risks. In other words, they pursued strategy C-type solutions for their institutions, and when economic downturns came, these institutions were susceptible to losses, and many of them did, in fact, fail. As a consequence of the thrift crisis, and what appeared to be a pending crisis in the banking industry, Congress and state authorities revisited the activities restrictions of banks and other depository institutions in the late 1980s and early 1990s. In our casebook, you will see several references to these statutory reforms and the new kinds of activities restrictions they imposed on depository institutions. I will be discussing them from time to time in this lecture series. One example I will just call to your attention at this point is the Regal-Neal Interstate Banking Act, which was passed in 1994. Under this act, banks were permitted to expand across state boundaries for the first time. In other words, they were allowed to increase the size of their geographic markets. Before 1994, banks were primarily restricted to doing business in a single state within the United States. After 1994, there was federal authority to expand on a broader basis and even nationwide. However, because it was perceived that this expansion could pose certain risks to the banking system, Congress decided that the authority would be granted only to those institutions that were adequately capitalized. In other words, that had adequate amounts of capital to bear the risks. In effect, this is a classic solution to problems of activities restrictions, that is, to require institutions that engage in more risky activities to have larger capital cushions. Another illustration of this phenomenon is the regulation of state chartered banks in the United States. As I mentioned earlier, banks in the United States are chartered under both state and federal law. prior to 1991, the states had considerable latitude in deciding what sort of activities state chartered banks could engage in. But in 1991, Congress, that is, the federal Congress, changed the law. And I've put the relevant provision up on this slide. Essentially, what it requires is that state chartered banks are not permitted to engage in any activities that national banks can't engage in unless two conditions are met. First, the corporation, which is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, must determine that the activity in question poses no significant risk to the deposit insurance fund. So there must be a particular determination that the new activity, for example, travel agency ownership, does not pose particular risks to the federal government's insurance fund. In addition, the state bank must have capital that is in compliance with applicable regulations. So again, another requirement of relatively high capital before engaging in any new activities not permissible for national banks. In practice, what this statutory provision has done is to make the activities restrictions authorized for national banks to be the presumptive activities restrictions on all banks in the United States. However, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, can expand the list of activities for state chartered banks if a specific determination is made. And in fact, a number of activities have been approved in this way. But it's an interesting illustration of tightened activities restrictions in the wake of the thrift and banking crises of the 1980s. To recapitulate our discussion of activities restrictions, let me just make a few final points. The primary lesson I would like you to take from this lecture is to understand activities restrictions as a response to the moral hazard problem I discussed earlier. The problem is depositors are incapable, it is thought, of self-help in this area. They are incapable of determining which institutions are engaging in risky activities and insisting upon getting appropriate compensation for risks passed along to the depositors. As a result, government seeks to, in essence, prevent strategy C through some sort of activities restrictions. Another important lesson to take away from this discussion is that there are limits on the effectiveness of activities restrictions. Amongst other things, it is difficult for the government clearly to define which activities are in fact risky, which in fact are strategy C type undertakings, and which are more innocuous strategy A or strategy B undertakings. And there is in fact a cost associated with the government being too cautious in this field. If, for example, the government were to prohibit not only strategy C, but also strategy A, then depository institutions would be forced to pursue strategy B, which is a lower return strategy for society. And while some of you expressed a preference for strategy B in terms of risk analysis, I think you all will appreciate that there is a cost associated with requiring institutions to pursue strategy B, and that's what overzealous activities restrictions can entail. Of course, as also discussed, even if a well-structured system of activities restrictions could be developed, it's not always simple to enforce those prohibitions, and various sorts of evasion strategies and recharacterization efforts can take place, and that was the lesson of our discussion of strategy D. A final point I'd like you to bear in mind is the fact that there are other regulatory solutions to the moral hazard problem. I discussed briefly capital regulation, which we'll look at in more detail in the next class, risk-based regulation such as risk-based deposit insurance premiums or governmental taxes on risk is another possible solution. Market discipline, that would be the example of depositors helping themselves by insisting on higher rates of return, is one approach. liability rules for individuals. I discussed the possibility of after the fact or ex post penalties on bank managers. That would be a possible solution. And of course, enhancing the skills of regulators to make them more qualified and better equipped to detect risk-taking through more frequent examinations or higher training of regulators is another sort of solution. There are other solutions that we'll consider later in the lecture series that I'll just note now. Regulating the organizational form of financial institutions is a kind of regulatory solution to moral hazard. In the examples discussed in today's lecture, the illustrations involved a limited liability corporation with shareholders seeking to maximize profit. There are other sorts of organizational structures that could be utilized for financial institutions, most notably in the United States, something known as the mutual form. Finally, social norms are another sort of regulatory solution. I mentioned earlier a number of the students in the class describe themselves as risk averse, and it's possible that one could rely on individuals of this sort or encourage bank managers to pursue risk averse behavior in order to fight against the moral hazard problem we've been discussing in this lecture. All of these are possible approaches to the regulatory problems we've been discussing in today's class. Let me return now to the Arnold Torres case we discussed last week and set an assignment for the class for this week's discussion group. In today's class, we've been discussing the risk problems associated with banks in engaging in higher risk investments, such as travel agency investments, which I have compared to strategy C in the exercise we worked on this week. It is, however, also possible to think of other reasons why we would not want banks to engage in investments in commercial activities such as travel agents. And what I'm referring to here is another justification for activities restrictions, which are antitrust concerns. Antitrust concerns are anti-competitive concerns, concerns about monopolization, concerns about unfair business practices. And so what I would like you to think about this week, and what I would like you to post comments on the discussion group about, are the anti-competitive concerns with allowing banks to invest in commercial activities. In particular, what I would like you to assume is that the risks associated with direct investments are not a problem. For example, assume that the government can impose a perfect risk adjustment tax or premium on higher risk investment strategies so that the owners of the intermediaries are required to take into account the true cost of their investments and no losses are passed over to the depositors. So assume that risk is not a consideration. Are there other anti-competitive reasons for prohibiting banks from having direct ownership in commercial firms? That means, might we worry that banks would do something with their lending practices that would be unfair to competition if they themselves were allowed to make direct investments in commercial firms? Try to think about this. If you have a reaction to this this point, those of you who have studied antitrust law may have some thoughts about this matter. Those of you who work in economics may have some thoughts about this matter. But try to answer this question: is there an anti-competitive reason for restricting depository institutions from investing in commercial firms? Please post your comments on the discussion group for lecture 3. And I will begin the next class with a review of those discussions and my own thoughts on the matter. In general, for next week, what I want to move to is a discussion of capital requirements. And in particular, the assignment for next week is to read through pages 184 to 209 of the casebook. In next week's class, I will focus on the two cases, legal cases in those sections, the Bank of Cuchada case and the Windstar case. As preparation for next week's class, what I'd like you to do is to try to work through problems 3-20 and 3-21, which is in the middle of this reading, and try to post answers on the discussion group for lecture 4 next week. I'm afraid my own schedule requires me to be away from my office at the beginning of the week, and so I will not be posting the lecture until Thursday morning, April 1st. I'll post it actually the day before, but it will be available to you on Thursday, April 1st. I would appreciate it if you could do the reading before that time and try to post responses to the problems 320 and 321 by Wednesday afternoon of next week, so by Wednesday the 31st of March. And I will, to the extent I can, respond to those postings in my lecture, which will be available the next day. So there are two sets of assignments I'm giving you all for the next week and a half. One is to think about the anti-competitive aspects about investments in commerce. And then secondly, for the following week, for lecture in preparation for lecture 4, please look over the materials on capital requirements and post your answers to problems 320 and 321. For problems 321, only respond to the first paragraph. It's a two-paragraph question. I only want you to work on the first paragraph. This concludes my third lecture for the Peking University Law Department on the regulation of financial institutions. I'd like to thank you all for your attention. I hope you found today's lecture of use, and I look forward to meeting with you again on the 1st of April.